At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world. Online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today was one of those days where the economic statistics gave and then they took away. We learned this morning consumer spending did pretty well last month. The Commerce Department said retail sales beat analysts' best guesses. But then those retailers, they said they don't see things the same way at all. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 13th of May. Great to have you here. Let's take a quick look at the economic tally sheet to set the stage, huh? We've got the credit squeeze in the negative column, ditto for the slide in real estate. But so far, those two have been balanced out barely, it should be said, by you and me. Consumers have kept the economy treading water for months now. And at first glance, this morning's numbers from the Commerce Department promised more of the same. If you take lousy car sales out of the equation, retail spending actually increased 0.5% in April. But, and you knew there had to be a but, right? There are some signs the big spenders are putting their wallets away. Walmart said today its sales have started to follow something called the pay cycle. That is, down as money runs out late in the week before the check comes, up when it's cashed. Bank of America seeing another pattern, people paying for basics with their credit cards. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio on families feeling the pinch.
Stay-at-home dad Jeff Polish hasn't had to live paycheck to paycheck, but his wife's check seems smaller these days, and he's heading back to work.
We've been trying to make ends meet and trying to cut back. It's tough. It's not easy.
What have you been cutting back on?
I would say on amount that we eat out and the amount that we purchase, although it's hard to say that when we have a newborn coming.
Polish and his wife planned ahead, but the nest egg's getting smaller. Consumers these days are getting squeezed from all sides. Their homes have lost value, the stock market's volatile, and the price of food and gas keeps rising. Liz Pulliam-Weston at MSN Money says it's difficult to cut a budget that's already down to the bone.
Families that have already been getting by on less income, that have already trimmed all the fat, are really in a bind now because there isn't much more that they can, you know, adjust or trim.
Some families may have to rely on relatives or the government for help or try to find more work. But in a faltering economy, that won't be easy. Still, Weston avoids doom and gloom predictions.
I don't think it's time to draw out the, you know, apocalyptic fantasies about the economy going into a hole in which it can't recover.
But she says it's time to start that family emergency fund, if it's not already too late. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Another day, another ripple in the credit crunch. Banks report they're seeing more loans to small businesses go bad. That means small businesses left standing or having trouble getting credit like they used to, and that in turn is hurting suppliers that sell to those businesses. So our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshea reports they're coming up with some creative solutions.
55% of loan officers say they've tightened their lending standards to businesses. So says a new survey by the Federal Reserve. Dee Smith runs a small construction company in Michigan. He says his bank recently cut back his construction loans.
They changed the rules during the process to I could only borrow 75% of the appraised value. And the only way I could do that, quite honestly, was to put it on credit cards, which is what I did.
The National Small Business Association says a third of small business owners now carry $10,000 or more on their personal credit cards. Todd McCracken is president of the association.
There's not much doubt that small companies are having a harder time getting credit. But it's also the case that with the economic slowdown we've seen, that fewer businesses are out there trying to get credit.
Less credit means less spending on things like software and computers. Suppliers of those products are responding by offering financing at generous terms. Ross Crane is the chief financial officer at Ingram Micro, a big technology supplier. This year, he started selling software for no money down.
With the economy the way it is and everyone talking about tight credit availability, what we've done is come out with a new suite of customizable leasing finance options.
Microsoft's boosting its financing arm by almost $800 million, and Office Depot will start renting computers later this year. I'm Jill Barshea from Marketplace.
The death toll from yesterday's earthquake in China's Sichuan province has now topped 12,000 and is expected to rise. Aid offers continue to arrive. Earlier today, the White House pledged $500,000. The International Olympic Committee has promised $1 million. But as the day wore on in China, the big question was whether Beijing would be receptive to those offers or would the government choose to go it alone. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Donation offers rolled in today from companies like Microsoft, Intel, and Dow Chemical. Foreign governments offered help too, as did international aid groups. All Beijing needs to do is accept the help. Kate Janis is with a nonprofit Mercy Corps.
China is a country where everything goes through the government. Whether you're working in the private sector, the civic sector, you need to wait for the go-ahead from the government.
Finally, late this afternoon, China said yes to money and to supplies. But no to relief workers, says Wang Zhenyao of the country's disaster relief unit.
It's impossible for even our own teams to reach the disaster areas. Conditions are not yet ripe for us to let international rescue teams to enter.
Still, many praise China's uncharacteristically quick response. 32 years ago, it rejected all outside help when a massive quake killed 250,000 people. And this past winter, Beijing reacted so slowly to a record winter storm, it had to apologize.
The Chinese government has apparently learned some lessons from that.
Dali Yang heads the East Asian Institute in Singapore. He says this time, Beijing sprung into action with its soldiers and doctors, all headed up by Premier Wen Jiabao.
How many premiers in the world who immediately rushed to a major disaster zone within a couple of hours of the quake? This is truly a leadership that's very determined to get things done.
As for outside help, he says China can use the money, but not so much supplies and equipment, since most of that tends to be made here. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We are way past oil at $75 a barrel. $125.80 was the close today, but Congress has a hankering for the good old days. The Senate voted today to force the White House to stop adding to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve until crude's back below that $75 level. The House is expected to vote the same way. Traders had an eye on the oil markets today. The other one was on those retail numbers I mentioned. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The strike-shortened television season's winding up, but the networks are already looking ahead to the fall. TV's upfronts are this week. That's when advertisers get a sneak peek at what broadcasters have to offer and then figure out what ad space they're going to buy. Television audiences, of course, have been declining for a while now. There's competition across hundreds of channels, not to mention the web. The writer's strike didn't help either, all of which mean network executives are doing whatever they can to attract viewers wherever they can. High-definition blockbusters or sitcoms on a cell phone. Problem is, they have to convince advertisers all that content's worth their money. So enter a new idea from Disney and its networks ABC and ESPN. ESPN's Vice President of Research, Artie Bulgren, explains.
We are establishing an emerging media ad lab.
An ad lab sounds pretty scientific, and it is. The word Bulgren used was clinical. Later this year, the networks are going to start measuring the emotional responses we have to advertising in all its forms, online, on screen, or on our cell phones. They're going to do it by measuring things like heart rate and this.
Galvanic skin response, which is a measure of skin conductance and gives us an indication of the viewer's state of psychological arousal while watching TV or engaged in other media.
Almost feels a bit like a lie detector test, so I'm sure it's going to freak a lot of people out, but you know, you never know.
Jim Cooper's executive editor at Media Week. He says once you get past the idea of watching TV with electrodes hooked up to your skin, the labs make sense for networks that are desperate to keep viewers' attention and advertisers' dollars.
If it works and it gives the networks a little bit of an insight into their consumers, it might be something that they could fold into their portfolio of marketing tricks to reach out to advertisers and viewers.
Still, I got to tell you, nothing beats skipping all those ads with the TiVo. For those of you who've been hoping the credit crisis is fading away, not so fast. Ben Bernanke said today he thinks financial markets are still, quote, far from normal. Of course, that kind of assumes the state of play before the squeeze was normal, where only Wall Street's best and brightest had ever heard of things like collateralized debt obligations and mortgage-backed securities. Financial innovations like that got lots of applause during the good times, but now they're taking the blame for the fix we're in. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, has more.
Much in the way some people argue that guns don't kill people, people kill people, there's a similar argument going around on Wall Street these days. Don't stifle valuable financial advances just because some greedy investors have been exploiting or even abusing the financial system. Harvard University finance professor Josh Lerner worries about throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
Much of the caution stems from a feeling that if we are too reactive, we may end up with a series of policies that end up stifling some of that innovation and doing it in a way that ends up affecting our prosperity going forward.
Without financial innovation, Lerner says the way we live would be much different.
It would be very limited in terms of the choices, in terms of the number of options we'd have in mortgages. It certainly would be in terms of our ability to borrow money for college, what kind of investments we could make. It would also be very expensive to go into and out of investments. Essentially, financial innovation has been behind a lot of these.
Michael Lewitt is president of Hegemony Capital Management, an investment advisory firm. He argues so-called innovations are exactly what got us into the mess we're in now.
There have been some benefits, but it has gone too far. You know, the abuses that were introduced into the system took those benefits and, you know, took a lot of them back.
Or, he says, diverted them to pockets on Wall Street. And Lewitt worries that greed isn't just siphoning away productive uses of America's money supply. It's even luring away the country's best minds.
What Wall Street did is it hired tons of math PhDs and science PhDs, and instead of having them, you know, figure out a cure for cancer, they had them figure out new derivative products so that Wall Street and hedge funds could make more profits. Now, listen, I believe in the free market, but the drain of intellectual capital into financial innovation and away from science and the arts and so on is a real negative.
Until recently, making a case like that might have brought a response that regulating innovation in the free market was un-American. Democratic Congressman Barney Frank, who chairs the House Financial Services Committee, traces that sentiment back to January of 1981.
Ronald Reagan was a dominant political figure in recent history, and in his first inaugural, he said, exact quote,
government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
What exacerbated this was you had people in power, essentially, who didn't believe even in good regulation. So it wasn't inherent that innovation could have gotten so far ahead of regulation. The philosophical view of the times is what made that happen.
Don't mistake Frank's position, though. He's committed to, as he put it, good regulation. But like the Bush administration, he's also vocal in defending financial innovation. And he doesn't hesitate to ridicule those who might want the pendulum to swing back too far.
I literally don't understand the concept. And when people say they don't want innovation, does that mean no stock market, in other words? As I think of financial innovation, I mean no mutual funds? I do not think you will find mutual funds in the Bible. certainly not in the Old Testament. I don't think in the New Testament. At some point, people created mutual funds. That's, by my definition, an innovation.
Nobody's really arguing mutual funds should be abolished, but Hegemony Capital's Michael Lewitt says it's obvious there are some unregulated bank activities that go way beyond positive innovation.
You know, banks should not be allowed to hide their assets off balance sheet. That's simple. That's wrong. It should not be allowed. Investment banks should not be leveraged 30-1, okay? 15-1 is enough. You know, there are a few simple things that can make the system more stable.
The experts we spoke to agree on this. The challenge will be striking a fair balance between beneficial innovation and prudent boundaries. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Economic innovations don't always come from Wall Street, you know. One of the most significant, for developing countries anyway, was perfected in Bangladesh and has since spread around the world. Microfinance, where, say, a farmer in Bolivia or a craftsman in Indonesia can get a small loan to build a business. The industry's grown at an average of 25% to 30% over the past 5 years. Commentator and economist Dean Carlin says microlending is a valuable tool if you understand all its effects.
Practically everyone has heard an inspiring story about a poor woman who takes out a $50 loan. She starts a business, now earns a steady income, feeds her children, and sends them to school. The idea of microfinance is powerful, and the stories are certainly inspiring, but there are several unanswered questions and potential problems. First, interest rates are on average around 30 to 40% per year. In some places, even as much as 100%. And most microfinance institutions require clients to already have businesses. In fact, most of these microbusinesses plateau in size fairly quickly. If the borrowers can generate the kind of return required to pay off their loans, why aren't their businesses growing? Also, in many markets, individuals are saying no to the loans being offered. Many continue to borrow from traditional moneylenders. What is it about the loan that makes them say no? Are the loan terms too expensive? Are they too inflexible? It's clear that loans are often used for household goods or to help pay for school fees or health emergencies. We should be happy that individuals borrow for these things. But wouldn't it be better to help them save or get insurance for medical care? Figuring out how to do that could have huge benefits. Some of the most important work in microfinance today is not on loans, but rather on insurance and savings. Why savings? The logic is simple. If someone borrows at 40% per year, every dollar less borrowed today could mean 40 cents more food on their table tomorrow. So how do we improve savings? Here's one way. Just as we can have automatic deduction from a paycheck, how about automatic deduction when a farmer sells his harvest? Or offer people savings accounts, which must be used to pay for education or health expenses. This is an exciting time for microfinance. There's tremendous potential for creativity to make big impacts on poverty. The trick is to delineate between what sounds good and what really works.
Dean Carlin is a professor of economics at Yale University. He's also the co-director of the Financial Access Initiative. Send us your thoughts online is best. Go to marketplace.org. Look for that link that says contact. Coming up, the terrible train rides of Mumbai.
After leaving the office, you're not that tired. But whilst going home, you get more tired. It was like just the travel part is killing.
But first, let's do the numbers. Markets were all mixed up today as oil prices hit another record high at $127. The Dow Industrials ended the day down a third of 1%, 44 points, closed at 12,831, the blue chips did. The Nasdaq moved the other way, closing up 0.2%, 6 points at 2495. The S&P 500 traded flat, finished at 1403. Retail sales numbers were lower again, as I mentioned, but no more than Wall Street expected. So Walmart reported rising sales, but its stock crumbled 2.3% after the company warned it could be a challenging year. Bond insurers had a bad day. MBIA dropped 5% and AMBAC fell 7% after rating agency Moody's said they could lose their precious AAA status. That would be a bad thing. AIG clawed back 2% as it closed on the sale of more than $5 billion in bonds. That's after a nearly $12 billion stock sale yesterday. Bonds fell. Yields on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.91%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for April. A Senate committee discusses the issue of children with food allergies. And the House Financial Services Committee examines causes and responses to the global food crisis. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
We devoted a chunk of time last week to the global food crisis. Many of you devoted a chunk of your time to writing to us about it. One of the stories in our series, Food Fight, focused on the big agribusinesses that are profiting amid those rising prices. Ralph Strom is a farmer in southeastern California. He wrote to us to say somebody is sure making money, just not him and his onion crop.
We're seeing about 10 cents on the farm level and a dollar at the retail when we go to the grocery store. So it appears that someone, we call him the middleman, is able to mark up these products many, many times.
Be it the middleman or the taxman, there were some concerns about a commentary we ran last week. Michael Mazurov said sales taxes ought to apply to goods bought online as well as to those bought in person. Frances Ellen Worrell runs what she calls an eco-fashion website in Heathsville, Virginia. She says building a loyal online customer base is tough enough. Forget about having to keep track of sales tax.
They're buying a sweater or whatever it is, sheets, and a shipping cost. If I were to have to also charge them taxes, I would be in a situation where they're going to look at what I'm selling and they might just say, oh, to heck with this, I'm going down to Linens and Things, and I simply can't afford to lose sales in that manner.
We learned a little something about our audience this past week. A surprising number of you seem to be structural engineers, who didn't much care for what I thought was my clarification of the use of the words concrete and cement in a story a couple of weeks ago. So just to get it firmly set in everybody's mind, traditional concrete needs cement as a binding agent, as well as water and gravel or sand, or both of those. And finally this week, moving past that cement thing, we got a load of comments slamming something we said about the new video game Grand Theft Auto 4, about how grown-ups playing video games could be thought of as immature. Eric Denny of Indianapolis said, hang on just a second here. He pointed out he's got a good job. He's an IT technician for county and municipal government there, and he's studying for his MBA. But he said everybody needs some downtime.
At the end of the day, I like to unwind a little bit, and I like to unwind by causing a little bit of chaos in a virtual computerized world.
And in his house anyway, Grand Theft Auto is strictly for adults.
I don't play it when the baby is awake. I wait until after he goes to bed, but yeah, I play.
If we do anything that is playing over and over again in your head, let us know. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Pump up the tires and strap on the helmet, gang. This is National Bike to Work Week. It's kind of an attractive option in the land of $4 a gallon gas if you're willing to risk your neck dodging traffic. Still, a bike commute here is way less dangerous than mass transit in some other places. Mehul Srivastava took a train ride in Mumbai, India's biggest city.
It's a blistering hot afternoon in Mumbai, and Surat Joshi is waiting to catch a train.
It's rush hour, and the train station is absolutely packed. Joshi is pushed to the edge of the platform by the crowds behind him, and then he sees the train coming.
Here it comes. What is the worst part of the travel?
Joshi is a software engineer, and he's one of 8 million people who take the train in Mumbai every day. The trains are easily the most crowded in the world. 500 people squeezed into a 200-person car. The trains stop for just a few seconds at each station, and they don't even have doors. So every day, about 14 people die just trying to get on and off a train. That makes Joshi's train ride one of the most dangerous in the world.
I really hate this part of the travel. I can opt for traveling by road, but then roads are really bad, and the only option left to me is traveling by trains.
When the passengers see the train coming, they rush towards the edge of the platform. And when it stops, a flood of people tumbles out, just as others try to push their way in.
You have to push through the crowd and get inside. I really hate it. Well, let me show you how you go about doing it.
My God!
That is nothing. That is nothing. Okay.
Inside the train, it is so hot and so crowded that most folks just concentrate on holding on. But like anywhere else in India, there's a guy trying to sell you something. Given a chance, nobody in their right mind would get on these trains. But for most folks, there really aren't any other options. The government subsidizes the train fare so much that Joshi paid about a nickel for his 15-minute ride. A bus ride could last an hour, and a taxi would cost more than a dollar. That's a lot of money in a country where most people live on a few dollars a day. But Joshi is young, and he's a guy. For women, children, and the elderly, things are much worse.
One word, hectic. Even though we travel by first class, doesn't make much of a difference. After leaving the office, you're not that tired. But whilst going home, you get more tired. It is like just the travel part is killing.
That's Nilofer Dadriwal. She takes a train every day. The 38-year-old bank employee has gotten good at pushing her way in and out of trains. But still, she realizes how dangerous her commute is.
It is, because people don't get to go inside because it's very crowded and they are most of the time hanging on the doors. We women too.
Railway officials say there isn't much they can do about conditions on these trains. R. Venkatraman is an official in charge of operations. He says not all the deaths are the railway's fault.
Safety is important for us. We are not ignoring safety. But we cannot be responsible for people who themselves are irresponsible. People climbing on top of trains, we cannot be responsible for them. We move millions of passengers daily.
And things may never get better. A $2 billion investment to increase capacity could take up to 5 years to show results. But by then, Mumbai, India's fastest growing city, will have grown by at least 2 million people. And almost all of them will be trying to take the train. In Mumbai, this is Mehul Srivastava for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, who's got time to worry about Steve Ballmer and Microsoft when you've got activist investor Carl Icahn breathing down your neck? Ballmer's bid for Yahoo is history, but Icahn is said to be considering a run at the internet giant. CNBC is reporting today that Icahn has started quietly buying up shares in Yahoo. He started last week, 50 million of them in all, about 4% of the company. Thinking is he'd launch a proxy fight to get new members on Yahoo's board of directors and then force CEO Jerry Yang to go back into negotiations with Ballmer. Yahoo shares picked up about 5% today on the news, still, though, nowhere near the $33 that was Microsoft's final offer. And that is our final offer. It's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow dropped 44 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ rose up 6 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 was pretty much flat. Miguel Macias works the overnight for the Marketplace Morning Report. The Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, a new Hollywood is born in Nigeria.
Africa, I can't even walk around the streets in Africa. It's crazy. I am like the Denzel of Africa. You know what I mean?
It's another installment of our series, Working. I'm Kai Rizdal, and I hope you can join us for it tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.